Welcome to the Living for Food Pod. It's Tuesday, and I have a very heartwarming and lovely conversation for you today. My guest wrote the first mainstream published cookbook in the U.S. based on El Salvador's cuisine, which is officially out today. That's right, today you can get the book. She is the executive producer and host of the Salvi Los Angeles docuseries, and the founder of the Salvadoran food culture and community named Salvi Soul. We opened up some really big conversations in this one, spanning from immigration to the pitfalls of journalism. I'd love to hear your thoughts on it. So as always, feel free to email me at livinforfoodpod@gmail.com with your comments, questions, concerns. Always remember to rate the podcast, preferably 5 stars, but I'll take any constructive criticism. But first, let's listen to my episode with the wonderfully talented Carla Tatiana Vasquez.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Well, thank you for coming on this lovely Tuesday and chatting with me. I came across your cookbook from a friend who reposted it. And I was like, I can't believe I haven't heard about this yet. So I'm really excited I was able to snag you before it launches.
Oh my goodness. Thank you so much. Yes, I've been so grateful for everyone sharing and posting about it. It's been quite a moment on social.
Oh yeah, for sure. I got a PDF and it was making me tear up a little bit. Like, the introduction is beautiful. I know you're also a writer contributing as well, but the introduction was like so well documented and well written that I was like, this is like one of the most beautiful things I've read in a while. So kudos to you on
that.
Oh
my goodness. Thank you so much. Oh my gosh. yeah, writing this book has definitely been a process of living my emotional journey in real time while writing this book. I don't know any other way that I could have finished this project. And so I really appreciate when folks read it and connect with it and really meet me where I was, because that's what this work has meant for me, is going deeper and really catching all the feelings, which is really what writing is. Writing is catching some feelings, and some of them are big and some are, you know, superficial and fun, and others kind of take you to places you weren't expecting.
That's totally accurate. And I think too, it's really hard to decide how much of your life you want to share. But I think with a project like this, it's pretty necessary for you to be as open and vulnerable as possible. And so people can not only connect with your recipes, but can connect to the history behind it. And that's what it seemed like you were kind of trying to find yourself.
Yes, 100%. Oh my goodness, there's so much I can say about that. This has been...
Go for it.
I mean, I'll tell you this. I think for a large part of my life, the thing I've been very fearful of has been separation. I did not have, I didn't have documentation as a child. I was able to finally get a green card when I was a teenager. I didn't become a citizen until almost, you know, out of my teenagehood. And so I kind of grew up with this looming fear of, if you don't do well in school, you may be separated from your mom and dad. You may be separated from your family. Yeah. I had already been acclimating to the fact that I was separated from a homeland. We didn't belong here. I was from some other place. And so I think for me now, in retrospect and as an adult, I can see that the enemy has always been separation. And the tools I found to fight that was food and cooking and family time. And hey, food always like cures separation. You want to see a friend and you haven't seen them for a while. You say, hey, let's go out to eat. And this, mm-hmm. you know, separation is cured all of a sudden, because there's food and you can come together. And so, so much of documenting this book and the reason for this book has really come from a place of vulnerability, of fear. You know, I grew up fearing a separation, and as I matured, I realized, well, I don't have to constantly be vulnerable to that fear. There's something I can do to it, and there are tools available to me, and I can learn these food ways that help me feel close to my homeland, close to some of the women in my life who nurtured me, who have now passed, and who inspired this project. So yes, it was very much a lot of putting myself on the page. And yeah. I had a friend who, she read some of the first pages that I wrote for Salve Soul, and she just, you know, gave me some feedback and said, you know, Carla, just let it rip. Let it rip. And I really took that to heart and said, if I feel scared to have this written down, if it feels too real, then I have to resist the urge to delete it or to rewrite it in a way that feels more easy to say.
Mm-hmm. That's a really, really good point. There's so many ways you can write something that makes it seem easier for you, and not, it's not necessarily a lack of honesty, but it's more about being candid with yourself and being honest with yourself and then putting that out into the world for it to be observed. It's a scary thing. And I was, you know, when you said the term separation, that's a really, really isolating term. To think, oh, I'm separated from my homeland in El Salvador. Now I'm supposed to be in my home, but I'm also separated from American culture. Did a lot of your struggle coming into your own identity come from trying to intertwine into American culture? Or was it more the lack of, not necessarily knowledge, but curiosity of trying to learn your Salvadorian culture?
I think it was always trying to understand my home. And like, if I look back and look at the years where I struggled to find connection, of course, it was always going to be hard to connect to American culture. That was a given. Like everybody, that was like a given, even within like other students who were American themselves, like they felt like they have had a hard time, like, what is it, right?
That's so true.
Yeah, it was not like, even though it was the default, there was also it left out a lot of people, right? It wasn't just, oh, because I'm from El Salvador, it left me out. It left out a lot of people. So if, you know, I think in the 90s when I was growing up, there was definitely the ideal was a thin white woman for if you were female, right? So that default will always leave out a lot of people. And so for me, I think a lot of this desire, and I talk about it in the book as anhelo, which is a word in Spanish that means yearning. The yearning I had in me was honestly always trying to understand what made me different and I'd sit at the dinner table and my parents would constantly share stories. Like they were addicted to sharing stories, and I really became addicted to listening to them because those story times really became a part of my formation. As the food nourished my body, these stories were nourishing this part of my soul that wanted to learn more about where we were from. My mom would talk about the fruit that would be ripe for the picking just walking down the street. And I'd have, you know, the way she would describe it, she would say, oh, Carla, it tastes better than cotton candy. And I would try to think of what tastes better than cotton candy. Like, just like, Carla, it's an unbelievable fruit that is free and it just grows and you only get it in these months throughout the year. So it just felt like there was a lot of magic that, you know, was shared with me about what El Salvador was. And it was all told through this lens of food, right? Food became this like time traveling portal that I could just imagine things in my head. And all of a sudden I felt like I could see in my mind's eye what my mom was describing to me with so much detail. So I think I had such a longing to see those things, to taste those things. And I would go to the grocery store here in the, you know, in LA and be like, there is no fruit here that tastes like cotton candy. Like my mom has tasted all of you. And yeah, oranges are great. You know, apples are great. Grapes are great. All of these things are great. But nothing, there's nothing that my mom will be like, this tastes better than candy. So I don't think it could have ever really been this, you know, my family was very much, yes, do what you got to do to survive. We've survived in El Salvador. We're going to survive here. So that meant learning English, doing the best I could with homework and managing societal things of, you know, of being in school and all of that. But there was always a priority of you are from El Salvador and you may not know everything of what makes you different, but that's who you are. And you're not here to assimilate to this culture because this culture will always reject you, will always refuse you any connection or acceptance, but this won't. The irony here is that the thing that won't reject you is far away. So it was always wanting to touch and see El Salvador. And I grew up with so much anxiety as a kid. You know that you were born somewhere else, and so you don't understand all the mechanics of what that means, right? Like that's adult language to say, like, okay, don't talk about where you're born because documentation becomes a part of the conversation. And I remember when I was in elementary school, I was maybe 8 or 9, and there were a ton of school, or, you know, my colleagues, my school colleagues, they were all talking about where they were born here in LA. And one of them said, oh, I was born in Cedar Sinai. Another one's like, oh, I was born in General Hospital. And I was just slowly like, how do I walk out of this circle slow enough so they don't see that I am not going to say somewhere in LA. I'm going to say El Seguro Social in Apopa, San Salvador. And the thing is that having those answers never satisfied the people who were around me because they immediately wanted to ask more questions. And those were questions I wasn't ready to answer as an 8-year-old, right? And then they would kind of poke at those issues and they would say, oh, well, where are you born, Carla? Okay, I was born in San Salvador. You don't know the place, so I'm not going to tell you the name, but in San Salvador, El Salvador, it's a country that's not here. And they're like, well, does that mean you have a green card? You know, are you a wetback? Like, those were things that were very a common occurrence growing up. And some of these kids didn't necessarily mean any harm, but
they just don't know.
They don't know, but it also means that they are hearing harmful narratives about immigrants. And so just because they don't mean it doesn't mean that what is around their environment doesn't get recycled to become harm. You know what I mean? So yeah, that was those were the things I was connecting as a kid and realizing, you know what? I could try to assimilate to this culture, but that would just create more anxiety. I think if I actually tried to understand where I'm from, where are the stories of resilience, of what it took my family to get to where we are now. Like if I could really put more meat on that structure, right? Maybe I might feel better. Maybe I might know where I'm from. And that perhaps can give me fortaleza, some strength, you know, to face whatever may come.
That is so hard as an 8-year-old. And especially as you grow up and then you get into puberty and you're already in such an awkward stage in your life. I was uncomfortable during that stage. I felt out of place a lot of the time. I know so many people I'm from Connecticut, literally in Connecticut, they felt out of place. So I can only imagine the added layer of not only being from here, but then the reaction that you received, and how are you supposed to process that as an 8-year-old? You're probably going to go home and be like, oh, mom, this person called me this today. And she's like, okay, well, maybe let's sit down and have a conversation about that, because that's not exactly an ideal scenario, you know? Mm-hmm. And I'd like to think that we're more accepting now, and there's a lot more accepting people in not only the school system, but our culture. But honestly, I don't even know that that's totally correct in the terms and the way that the states are going right now in general. So I commend you a lot for being able to getting through that and finding your way to embracing the culture that you were born with, because you could have very easily rejected it, like American culture rejected you originally.
Yes. I mean, there were a lot of stories that, you know, my family would share, and they almost sounded like fairy tales. Like you'd hear an aunt say, oh, by the way, fulana de tal, that's how we say it, a lady, fulana de tal in El Salvador used to go by Margarita, but now she goes by Maggie. And she does not want anyone to know that she's from El Salvador. And so it was like this hush, hush, hush of like, there were some folks who really, you know, and you can understand the struggle, right? There were some times when growing up where a lot of times people would confuse me and say, oh, where in Mexico is El Salvador? And they thought that, they thought El Salvador and Mexico were the same thing. And so they just assumed I was Mexican. Okay. And I would say, no, I'm not Mexican. El Salvador is a small country. It's not as big as Mexico, but it's there. There was also a lot of people understood what that was, you know, that identity was Mexican. And so I did often feel pressure to just give them an answer that was easy. Give them an answer that felt easier, because to say you were from El Salvador meant that you opened yourself up to so many other questions. You know, do you have a green card? You know, do you have any relatives in MS-13, which was the big scare of everybody, MS-13, a very violent, violent group. And so, yeah, it was navigating a lot of things that, as a young person, oh gosh, I don't know. I think
you already have enough going on.
You already have enough. Like, I already was learning English. It was just everything about not everything. I won't say that, but a lot of my childhood really hinged upon like, how well am I managing everything that's coming at me? And as an adult, I realized that a lot of trauma, you know, you kind of, in order to write something like this, you kind of have to give yourself some vocabulary for how trauma kind of manifests itself in your life, you know? And one thing I've learned about it is that trauma really is like things that are too fast, too soon, too much, right? And I think that was a lot of my childhood. There was so much happening so fast that there was no time to really process one thing, let alone several compounded things. And so having all of that to process as a kid, you don't get a chance to do it until maybe you're out of your 20s and now you're like, hey, maybe I can take a breather. And that's if life maybe got a little bit more stable, you know. We eventually, everything comes up to the surface and you have to deal with it. And then cooking became kind of the safe place for me to deal with those things. And, you know, interviewing my grandmother and asking her questions.
That's adorable.
Yeah, like asking her questions about, you know, some of the traumas that she experienced, it would be really hard to, you know, kind of ask an elder face to face like this and be like, hey, tell me the why tell me everything, right? But it became easy. Mm-hmm. And there was a little bit of a buffer because we're cooking and kind of doing something fun, but it's also productive because we get a meal out of it. And so you can touch those sore spots without having to be so intense about it, you know? And that's right. What really made some of the healing, a lot of the healing happen, was being in the kitchen, touching food, you know, getting in there. And yeah, goodness.
No, you are so, so well spoken. And I think it's such a beautiful thing when you come of age and you're able to decipher your own history, but you're also at a mature level where your elders are willing to talk to you about theirs. Mm-hmm. There's such like a beauty, and it sounds like they pass on a really deep understanding or appreciation more to you, especially when it comes to food and your heritage, and being able to ask them those questions that a lot of people don't think to mm-hmm. ask, quite honestly, especially through a cookbook process. Like, there's things that come up that you're like, oh wow, like now I can learn about this, or now I can learn about that. And I think it really opens up a lot of doors to learn, and because they have so much wisdom that we just don't even know about. And, you know, you and yourself dealing with your own traumas, you have wisdom that you can kind of relay to mm-hmm. them. So the two-way street is really interesting to me. But I really liked this quote from your book, so I'm going to read it here. You wrote, "When I was in elementary school, asking my mom about our traditional recipes became a habit. She often found my curiosity frustrating because I was looking for an easy answer to something that had taken her whole life to develop." And that's so interesting to me, because in a time where we expect such like quick answers to things, and in terms of recipes, quick recipes the next day or whatever it is, we don't necessarily look at it as the entirety of someone's life or life's work. And I feel like that's just so interesting to me. Did you find yourself constantly observing her in terms of cooking? Gosh.
Yes. I mean, I think a lot of Salvadoran moms, or a lot of moms in general, we mm-hmm. think of the kitchen space as this very, you know, we see these trends of romanticizing your life, right? It's very romantic. It's sensual.
I love that.
We can use your senses, right? However, and I enjoy that too, the thing that I've noticed is a culture gap, is that for a lot of the moms before us, or even just our elders, people who are older than us, there isn't a romance with the kitchen. There are sharp objects. There's fire. There's a lot of grit. There's a lot of drudgery. Like, you got to do stress. The dishes. There's stress. There's like, oh my gosh, this is $20-something of groceries. I better not fuck it up, right? So there's and not to even add into that, there's hungry people on the other side of this that if I don't get this meal done, then what are mm-hmm. we going to eat, right? So I think for me, every time I tried to kind of share the kitchen space with my mom, she was very much about efficiency. We are not having a Hallmark moment. This is not where we have it, you know? This ain't it, you know? And mm-hmm. I had to really quickly assess that it wasn't her rejecting me, because she's where I'm getting a lot of our culture, right? Our matriarchs mm-hmm. give us a lot of answers, right? To the questions that we have as to like, what do we do when we grow up? What do we do when we have a kid? Our matriarchs give us those answers. And so I'm growing up thinking, I want to get these answers as to how, what we cook from our homeland, right? And I'm trying to be in this space with her, but she's very much like, this is not a school. This is a small ass kitchen that needs to feed all of these people. So I need mm-hmm. to be about efficiency, you know? And so I learned that if I wanted to learn, I needed to have a real respect for this. And I need to respect her time that she has. If you're not here to help her job be easier or more efficient, then you need to get out of her way. And so the best thing I can mm-hmm. do about learning is observing. And so that became my addiction. I have a little seat in my mom's kitchen and I always sit there unless she says, Carla, help me with, I don't know, even now as I'm in my 30s, finished a cookbook, she still will be like, you can chop the vegetables, you know, like there is still some things that, because that is the thing, like now in today's day and age where food is really entertainment and it's nothing in some ways and it's everything in other ways, there's still some mm-hmm. truth about how in real time, like if we are sharing space in a kitchen, you have to kind of be about it. And you have to say like, okay, we need to get food on the table. So this isn't a class where I'm going to give you the A to Z about this dish, you know? So mm-hmm. I really became addicted to asking my mom questions or observing her or asking her, Mom, I noticed you added more salt to that. What talk to me, you know, why, mm-hmm. what was the reasoning for that? And she would say some stuff like, oh, Carla, tu paladar solo te dice. She'd say, your palate just speaks to you. It just tells you. And I'd be like, dang, my palate is not saying anything to me. Like, how are you getting your palate? Yeah. How are you getting your palate to give you instructions? Like, uh-huh. And of course, like all of that, you know, you start to realize it's a skill that takes time and it's practice, it's muscle memory. It's a lot of beautiful things that I don't think we take a moment to stop and appreciate. Oh, hey, this kind of takes a skill set. This takes some know-how. There's methodologies mm-hmm. here that I'm taking for granted. And I think that a lot of times that happens, especially in food media. I have come across this so much with pitching my book. A lot of times, this has taken mm-hmm. me 8 years, right, to see this wow. book be done. And a lot of it was because certain agents, you know, one agent said to me, oh, Carla, this sounds great, sounds beautiful, but I don't think the American public will know what this is. Or Salvadoran just feels too niche. Maybe you should have stuck to like doing something on all of Latin America. And it's like, but that's not what
that's the point.
Yeah. And so there were a lot of things where I felt like, I feel like they're telling me something, but I'm seeing so many examples of the opposite, right? So I'm seeing another cupcake cookbook, another book on Italian food, and I love Italian mm-hmm. food. I also feel
please,
like
we have a million cookbooks.
We have a lot of Italian cookbooks, you know. Mm-hmm. I felt like you're telling me that something, and that is meant to communicate to me that my idea isn't a good one, but I'm seeing other ideas that are not as good as mine still getting greenlit. So which one is it? You know, like pick a struggle, because you're trying to you're getting in my way. You're getting in our way of really elevating access to culture, you know? So mm-hmm. there were a lot of things that I felt I was in a place where I was connecting a lot of these dots, where I was observing what was happening in my mom's kitchen, of her knowing all these beautiful things and realizing there's nowhere where I see them documented, right? And then mm-hmm. observing and making those connections within the food media world and saying they're not going to be the ones to document this because they are saying there's no value in it. It's not French cooking, it's not Italian cooking, but those are not the only two cuisines that deserve to be documented for many to enjoy.
I mean, and you said it too, it's like food is very much entertainment nowadays. It's, I think, hard to differentiate the content creation versus what you're actually presenting, if that makes sense. As far as like the Italian and the general cuisines, I think they're underestimating the amount of people who would want to learn about new foods. Because just because people are buying the Italian books doesn't mean that they're not interested in other things, or it could possibly mean that they really, really enjoy cooking and those are their only options. You know, it just, when you think about it on a deeper level, it just doesn't really make sense to not have more niche categories. And I know there's probably, I don't know, are there even one or two Salvadorian cookbooks out there? I don't even know.
Yeah, so there, the Salvisil cookbook is the first to be traditionally published in the States. And
it's that's just, incredible.
Which is, isn't that crazy? Like in 2024, we can still have first. It is. That is so true.
I'm like,
yeah, it feels crazy. It has also meant that this road has been, you know, you have to do proof of concept. So it means a lot of championing, a lot of fighting, a lot of not giving up, you know. But because there are other Salvadoran books, they have just been self-published by independent publishers. Because, you know, those books, I don't know if they ever wanted them to be traditionally published, but I'm sure even if they're saying, oh, Carla, people don't want this, I can't imagine what they would have said like 10 years ago, you know, or 20 years ago.
Probably not nice things.
Yes, probably not nice things. And so I do feel like, you know, back to, you know, the point you brought up about things maybe being a little bit better now, I do feel like the conversations are shifting. And that is a sign of progress. I still think that there's so much more to be. The fact that this is the first one in 2024 is a great thing, but it also is a symptom of a problem, right? Like, wait, why has this been? And hopefully it's not the only one, you know. Hopefully what we hope is that this will open doors, right? And that this will show publishers, hey, these are not niche ideas that will get niche sales. This is going to be, you know, something that people are hungry for. And it's a lot.
I believe it. And I wonder too, I feel like niche is just almost an insult, because it's like you're minimizing it in some sort of way, as it's not important as the Italian or French cooking or Chinese cooking or whatever. Do you feel any extra pressure with this cookbook launch because it's technically the quote first one, or are you more excited? Like, what are your feelings coming up to it?
I feel a lot of anxiety. Yesterday I was on a walk with my husband and I finally felt like I had some visuals as to how to describe the feelings in my body. And I was like, you know, Iron Man with that huge hole in his like chest cavity, like that is how I feel sometimes, where I can't breathe because some, like, it feels like stuff is missing, or it feels like there's a hole here, and it like feels sore and raw. Like, that is the anxiety I feel sometimes. And it, to me, so much of this is my emotional personal life. This is also a anthology of women's stories. This is also a culinary book. It's doing so many things at the same time. And so I hope that somewhere in all of those angles, people will get something and appreciate. I know there's so much there, but I still can't escape the anxiety of, you've done something that you've poured 8 years of your life into, and you hope that it that it goes well. You know, my husband and I, this is something that has taken a lot of priority. Our last kind of break that we've had as far as like time off was probably our honeymoon, because so many of our resources have just gone into the book, into this project, into recipe ingredients, testing things out, being available to this project, because it requires time and resources. And yeah, there's an immense anxiety, also an overwhelming amount of joy. We've documented 80 recipes, and it's recipes and stories from different women who I've spoken to and gotten to know over the years. And to me, it gives me so much peace knowing that some of the stories that are in the book are documented, and that part of our story will always be there forever, you know. I grew up listening to stories that my grandmother would share, my mom would share, my great-grandmother would share, everyone in my family. You would realize, like, sometimes it would cost them something to share them because they were so hard, right? And then the lesson that they gained from that story, you realize, oh my gosh, like, that cost them something. You know, it cost them years of their life, or it cost them tears or real pain, right? And so them sharing that story means that I need to hold it as sacred and really learn that lesson with them, because it was too precious to ignore that lesson, or to let time just forget about it, you know. So that brings me so much joy. It's a mixed bag, to be honest with you. I feel so excited to look forward to April 30th, which is our publication date, but also really...
That's when this episode will drop.
Oh my gosh, yay! Thank you. so crazy that it's finally here, and it won't belong to me. I'm in my office, which used to be a closet, but now I turn into my office, and it's just been me in this room writing this book, putting my heart out, and now it's going to be outside of this room in so many places, and that feels so thrilling and exciting, and also kind of like, oh wow, that is,
yes, oh shit.
Yes. So
you're like, oh my gosh. Yeah, I would love to say that in terms of the anxiousness that comes with that, I mean, that's a given. I'm an anxious person too, so I understand that to my core. But the amount of resources and efforts that you put into it could cause that immense anxiety, but I think that could also be the strength in what makes it successful. Mm-hmm. We talked about food being entertainment, and while there are some caveats to that, the pros to that are people really like personality. Mm-hmm. They like hearing the background. They like hearing the culture of it. I was just talking to a woman who will, her episode will air the week after yours. And, you know, she's Lebanese and Mediterranean, and that's what she connected with people on. So I think that will definitely shine through. And then the added layer of you highlighting women in a time where women are so freaking powerful right now, I think it's a recipe for success, in my opinion. I know it's like, wait, that was actually
good. Yeah, it was. Good job.
I didn't even need to say that, but it was. Yeah, you know, I think you can kind of try to turn that anxiety and be like, all of this work, and now you just have to let it go into the world, and the world will hopefully, and I think it will, lift it up too. The fact that you're doing all of this and highlighting women, it'll go on for generations. And I think it's a really, really cool and powerful thing for sure.
Thank you. Thank you for those. Yeah, they mean a lot.
I actually have a question for you, because the listeners that I have kind of span everywhere. And I think it would help anyone out there who maybe is struggling with their identity or kind of going through something similar that you went through, especially as a kid, if there was any advice you'd want to give to your younger self, what would it be and why?
Oh my goodness.
It's a tough one.
And you know what? Because this is, we do say, you know, this is the first cookbook. I've gotten a lot of questions about like advice, and the way I look at the trajectory of my work, I have to be honest and say, unfortunately, there were such unique circumstances that happened in order for me to get to this point. Like, there were people who guided me, who I didn't in some ways they feel like angels who helped guide me to where I needed to be next for the next thing. So the only thing I can really mm-hmm. say that I had some control over was I reached the point of no return a long time ago. And that was the minute I started this, it was in 2015. And I was crying thinking, I want to start this, but I am afraid no one will care. I'm afraid I don't even have to kind of suppose that people won't care, because there hadn't been any Savvy Cookbooks. Historically, it's been a community that is always put on the margins, right? My community has often been ignored and invisible. I don't have to wonder. I have facts that tell me people haven't cared. So why will they care about this? And it was working through those feelings and finally saying, but you know what? I care. I fucking care. And that mm-hmm. has made all the difference. Because eventually caring enough meant that it became fused with me. Like sometimes people call me Salvi Sol. They're like, hey, you're Salvi Sol. I'm like, yes, hi. You become one with it, right? Because I don't know how to let go of this. Because if you don't care, I don't care about what you don't care about. I care that it's important to me, and that is all I have time right. for. And so that quickly gave me such a standard of, I won't work with an agent, with a publisher who makes me feel like they're doing me a favor. No, I'm doing all the work. I'm doing all the work. They're here to help me. If they don't give me like, hey, I want to champion this with you energy, I don't want to work with them.
I'm gonna clap. Like, honestly, that is so freaking empowering. I'm like, you know what? You're here to yes. help me, and you know, minimizing you to like they're doing something for you is just absolutely absurd. So that
yes, makes me angry. Yes, you because you sometimes you get you there's this narrative of like, pobrecita, poor you, right? Or you're from this marginalized community, you're from some small little country, right? I've heard it all, you know. And yes, so what? You're just telling me information I already know, but you don't know how much I care. So I don't have time for you. I've just decided I'm going to insist on staying here in this care, in this passion, and I'm going to build my house here. Then you can help me build or get the fuck out. The door's over there. And mm-hmm. that has made all the difference, because if I hadn't found an agent, I wouldn't have found this book deal. 10 Speed Press has been a dream publisher. But if I hadn't found all those things, I think I would still be doing this. I would be in a much more tired state, more anxious state, right? But I honestly don't know that I would have known how to stop. I would not know how to stop until we got the book deal, you know. So call it like perseverance. I don't often love the word perseverance, because it means that we're normalizing a culture that means things have to be hard, right? So I'd much rather say, yeah, I have the choice here. It's not like my circumstance.
Maybe the tenacity. Yeah.
It's me choosing mm-hmm. to live where my passion is. And it's me choosing who gets to share it with me and who gets to build it with me. And I think that if I can give someone maybe that kind of guiding star advice, then that's what I'll go with.
That I'm gonna stitch that on a freaking pillow. I'm like, you're so right about the perseverance thing, because it just implies that you constantly have to grind and choose whatever you're grinding towards above yourself, your peers, yeah. whoever, whatever success you're reaching towards. And it just is like, it's that American dream corporate ladder scenario that is just so freaking infectious mm-hmm. and needs to go. And I think it is going. I think my generation is finally learning that you can do the things that you want to do. You can make a good living off of it, and you can inspire people. And, you know, your book is just one more mm-hmm. inclusion in that. And there's a lot of food history too in this book. And, you know, you said it includes 80 recipes. Are there any insights or like interesting anecdotes that maybe you can give us a slight excerpt on, or something that you were surprised about that you want people to know about?
I think, you know, I almost feel like I can bet money that the one dish that people know about from El Salvador is pupusas.
I was going to say that.
We love pupusas. I am a huge fan. I love pupusas. There is definitely, of course, so much more to the cuisine. And some of the recipes that I really had so much fun with was actually some of the seafood recipes, because I don't know why. Ooh, okay. It feels like with Salvadoran food, people don't often think that there are a plethora of seafood dishes, when, of course, there would be. We have a coast right there, and also like all of the rivers and lakes in El Salvador. Mm-hmm. But yeah, they're some of the, one of my favorite dishes is conchas rellenas. And these are blood clams that are essentially, you take out the clam meat and you cook it with some pork and some herbs, okay. some aromatics. And then you actually you make this filling, and then you place it back into the little clam, and you put it in egg batter and finish it in a tomato sauce. And it's very delicious. And I kind of love how labor intensive it is. The first time I made it, this was one of the women, Carolina, who taught me this recipe. And, you know, she, mm-hmm. the way she set the scene was like so beautiful. You know, her family is from La Libertad, which is right by the coast. She's like, oh, you know, her family owns a bed and breakfast, and after you've spent the day just being out in the water and getting tossed and everything by the waves and just enjoying mm-hmm. yourself until your body is spent from all the energy, you come in, you eat these little stuffed clams and enjoy yourself. And just I loved that scene in my head, that just seemed so tantalizing. Mm-hmm. And when I made this dish, I felt like this is exactly what what I wanted to do is make sure that some of these recipes aren't lost to time, aren't lost. We can do a lot with oral history, thank goodness, right? We can always pass down these consejos, these pieces of advice. Mm-hmm. We can also, though, really do a lot when we write it down. And, you know, I've made this now several times, and it's one of my dad's favorite dishes now. And I love seeing him eat, you know, the dish. I love it. And it is a little tedious because you have to clean each of the clams because you put the filling back in. But even that, that is just, it's beautiful.
It's worth it.
Yeah. It feels very much like a showstopper, you know?
Mm-hmm. It must be so exciting to infuse the stuff you learned into your own family's habits and culture. That must be really cool. How did you go about finding some of the women to showcase, if I could ask?
Yeah, of course. I'm kind of curious. No, absolutely. That's definitely part of the story. I first mm-hmm. started with my grandmother, and then I interviewed a few of the women in my family and just said, hey, I don't know what I'm doing, but I have this idea. And eventually some of my mom's family friends kind of came into the mix, and my one high school friend, Salvi friend, came into the mix. And then it just slowly, over maybe 2 years, I had 6 women. And then I was let go from my nonprofit job where I was the director of community programs. And my grandmother was getting sick at the time, and she was getting sicker. And so I decided, you know what? What if I do a call out? What if I just put it on Twitter and everywhere. This was in 2017, and just said, if you have a Salvi mom who loves to cook and wants to share her story, I would love to interview her. And so that's how I got the remaining people. And there were calls that I got from people in Michigan, not just LA, but Michigan, Boston, Paris, people in Japan, like everywhere. They're like, how far are you traveling? And this just, you know, it.
How far did you travel?
I only traveled to Southern California because it was a lot of people who were calling me from DC, Georgia. And, you know, it just goes to show that so many in the Salvadoran diaspora want to stay connected to home. You know, we have what we scholars say is a transnational identity, which means we live here or we live wherever we are, right? That is in El Salvador, but we still want to have a connection to the land. And so tons of people called and I had to say, if I can drive to you, I will go, but I cannot fly to you. We are not on that budget right now. And
unless they're paying for your Paris flight.
But yeah, so that's how I found the women. And thankfully, you know, a lot of them I met in 2017 and they have stuck with me, which is incredible. We met just because a son or somebody of theirs introduced us or nominated them. And I was also very clear about, I didn't want to pursue the women. I wanted them to pursue me because I have seen what it takes to share a story that maybe costs you something, right? Like we talked about. And so I didn't want it to seem like I was trying to get something from them. I only wanted to talk to them if they were ready to share, if they wanted a platform to share something that was on their terms and never me like poking like, hey, tell me about this thing, you know. I was like, no, 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 I'm here. I have my phone. I've got my voice record app ready when you are. Because sometimes with stories and storytelling and even communities of color, we think, oh, they have a great story to tell that teaches us so much about humanity and teaches us something about living. However, sometimes repeating that story is harmful to the storyteller, and it should not, we should not undermine that harm for the sake of what good it'll do for people. And so if we can't take care of the storyteller, we're essentially not able to take care of ourselves. And so I really wanted to always let them know, like, this is your show. I'm really here as the person making an introduction to the readers, as the person documenting this and, you know, archiving this history. You know, I'm so grateful that we were able to do that with these stories.
I will say that that's something I struggle with too as a journalist, is just sometimes I don't know if this might be a strong word, but like sometimes I just feel like such a vulture, like asking all these questions and like poking and prodding, and you kind of, especially if you're interviewing, you know, people who are high profile, I just feel like I just am asking them questions to get what I need to get, and that's really it. And that's like not really who I am or what I enjoy doing. I like to get to the root of people if they're willing to do that, you know, like I'll always say, especially on this podcast, like you definitely do not have to go as deep as I'm asking. Like you can revert back on whatever you're comfortable with. So I think that's definitely important, and making them feel comfortable with you too.
Yeah. The thing is, I went to school for journalism, and I felt like so often, you know, you have to get that soundbite or you have to get that little thing. And the thing that we have really convoluted, because it's, I don't know, modern age, right? Stories are commerce. It is a business. Movies are stories, and that's a business, right? The news is stories. That's information, you know? And so stories are also culture. It's also who I am as an emotional being, right? and that's not for sale, right? And so I think sometimes there is so much we can learn as people in journalism of like what we can also decide that, you know, our listeners might just appreciate this. Like, they don't need to know this thing. Or I'll give you an example. I went into one of the interviews and one of the children asked me, hey, ask my mom about this thing. It's a really good story. I think it was like how she crossed the border or something like that. And I said, okay. I was grateful for the tip. You know, we always appreciate a good tip. And so I went in, asked those questions, and very quickly learned that those were stories meant for family ears only. And it didn't matter how much I pushed or just gently like suggested, hey, maybe you want to tell me about this. I don't want to tell you about that. And I was so grateful for that lesson. Yeah, put me in my place. Who am I to ask you those questions, you know? And I think that there should be some
boundaries.
Like, you know how people are always saying like media training, right? I feel like media training needs to go the other way also. You should empower your speaker to be like, I want you to put me in my place if I've crossed the line, because that makes me a better person, because we don't need to exploit our pain. We don't need to normalize like communities of color always sharing these traumatic episodes, right? And even now, as I'm doing media for the cookbook, I'm learning that it's still something I need to, like, everyone is free to ask a question. I don't need to answer it the way you want me to, though. And sometimes, you know, if I feel the pressure to do it, someone who hasn't been in the media or who's, you know, wanting to just help somebody out with their project or whatever it is, they may feel the pressure and just answer. And then at the end realize, whoa, that feels really icky. And then maybe not have the language for what just happened. So I feel like maybe we're hopefully entering, or maybe I don't know if we are entering, but perhaps there's a new way that can be learned where we don't have to just get that thing. We don't have to be so going with an agenda. And some of the stories are not all, some of these are very tender stories, you know, about one of the women. All she wanted to talk about was how she never learned how to read or write. And the one thing she wanted to learn was how to tell time. And she couldn't figure it out. And she couldn't figure it out. And she was essentially, you know, now she's in her 60s and she realizes she has such compassion for the people that were trying to teach her. She's like, no wonder they were so crazy. I mean, because I have a learning disability that I didn't realize I had until my 60s. So what kind of resources was I going to get in the world in that time? And, you know, she holds them with so much compassion when they were really her tormentors, you know. And then she shares that, you know, well, I won't ruin the story, but it's in there. And that is that is part of what teaches us something about humanity. Like, it tells you a little bit about who we are as people in those moments, in these little vignettes. We all have odysseys to tell, and we can't tell them completely, but we can capture these little windows of who we are in those moments, and that can really shed a light about who are, or what our values are, what our principles, how we carry ourselves.
I've definitely observed over my years writing that, this is a very general statement, but some journalists feel they have a right to know things, especially in celebrity culture now. They're like, well, we have a right to take photos of you. We have a right to ask you a question about your personal life. And I was speaking to one of my actress friends, and I was like, you know, I'll pretend to interview you. Like, let's just pretend, see how it goes. And I was trying to explain to her, like, you can just say, you know what, I don't know, or I don't want to answer that. Like, there's something powerful about realizing your boundaries, but not only that, but just putting up boundaries with other people, especially in a society where we feel like we have to know everything. We have a right to know everything about people who are in the limelight, for sure. It's an interesting phenomenon that I don't know if we'll figure out, but hopefully we will.
Yeah, it's a case by case. We can always, you know, it's very true that once we know better, hopefully we do better. And I've definitely been, hold myself to that standard because, you know, I started with my grandmother. So when I interviewed these women who so graciously and generously invited me to their homes, I felt like I am talking to my grandmother. And if somebody came in poking around her emotional trauma wounds, I would be fuming. So I really made sure to be like, hey, you wouldn't want your some stranger lady from Instagram coming into your grandma's house, you know, asking her all kinds of questions. So don't you do that to anybody else. And if they reprimand you for it, say, thank you so much. You know, thank you. Thank you.
It's like such a privilege too. I think if we look at it like a privilege, we're even getting to speak to these people and like even having you on here, it's like a privilege to hear your story. And I think if we shift the vocabulary into that, I think it could be a better relationship in terms of storytelling and who's telling them and how we're telling them. All right. I know we got really deep for this past hour. So let's do something. Let's do something fun. Normally what I do is I have a short game and I kind of pin two foods against each other, but I didn't feel like I was educated enough to pin Salvadoran foods next to each other. And I didn't want to do a disservice. So instead, I'm going to ask you a question. What do you think is the most underrated Salvadorian food, or at the very least, one you think people should know about aside from the clams you mentioned? And of course, everyone knows.
I will say rellenos de whisky. Rellenos de whisky are a vegetable that we call it whisky, but a lot of other Latin American countries know it as chayote. So it's a green squash. Mm-hmm. It's a little sweet, and we cook it with some cheese. So we have a little slab of cheese sandwiched between two slices, and then we put that in an egg batter and finish it off in a tomato sauce. And it is one of I can eat 6, 7, 10 of them, and I'll always have room for more. I love rellenos de huizquil, and you can't ever find them on a restaurant menu. It's something that your mom makes, or it's true Salvadoran home cooking.
Oh, I'd love to experience that. I went to my first Salvadorian bakery, which I'm kind of embarrassed to admit because I wish I did it sooner this year. And we had like La Peperecha, which is, it was so good.
Yes.
I was like, I ended up writing an article about this small bakery, and I got to talk to them, which was also very cool because they were also explaining how the nostalgia is really what brings customers in, and kind of what you're explaining before. It's that pride, but also that connection to your childhood that really the customers come into. But I had that and I was like, where have these been all my life? Like, why have I not been eating this? And so I literally brought some home.
I love that.
To the East Coast where I'm from. And I like made my family try it. I was like, please try this.
Yes. And peperecha, let me tell you, is, I don't know if they explained to you, but the peperecha is kind of a nickname for like a scandalous woman because it's hot pink. Yeah, and so it's also the name, what we've named things is, it's very cultural too. It's not just like, oh, it's connected to the way the ingredient is in it. Like, it's not like, a blueberry scone is called blueberry scone because there's blueberries in it. But this one, the berbereccia has nothing to do with what's in the pastry, more so how it looks, and it's flashy. So that's why it means berbereccia, because, oh,
so funny.
They're a scandalous woman or something like that. But it's fun. I'm so glad that you had that experience.
Me too. I'm like, I've been really trying new foods recently and trying to do really more research, you know, beyond my Italian American roots. And, you know, I love Mexican food, but again, that's kind of everywhere now. Not complaining because I still love it, but still. Mm-hmm. But for people at home, la pepperoncina is like a, I don't even know if I would describe it as like an elevated fig Newton kind of thing. It's more like a soft graham cracker with a filling in the middle.
Yeah. So
if that makes sense, you can probably do it better than me.
I liken the dough to pepperoncina to like a very thin pie crust, because it's a little bit short, right? The dough, and there's like a little pineapple jam in it. Sometimes it's different fruit, but most people will do like a pineapple jam, and it is very thin. So it is kind of, I guess, I had never thought about it in that way, like a fig Newton. But if you were really searching for like some example to help people kind of visualize what it is, it's not too far off. But yeah, it is kind of like a short crust pastry dough with a pineapple filling, very thin, and a super hot pink sugar coated topping. And it looks so fun to eat. You're just like, ooh, what's that?
Yeah.
It's hot pink.
It might make your mouth a little red from the sugar, but
100%.
It's worth it. I know. I've noticed too that I've kind of had to make a comparison with American foods sometimes when I'm trying to explain, especially in articles, when I'm trying to explain what a dessert is or what a food is, because a lot of people just need that comparison to visualize it. But at the same time, I want to make sure I'm not Americanizing.
Yeah, I think it's a good habit I once heard it said that if you, as a writer, share a cliche, then you're essentially telling on yourselves because you don't actually know what's really happening. And as a writer who wants you to feel something, I have to really discipline myself to really observe what is going on. And so the same application can be used to food, right? What is going on? What is this dough? Because there might be someone who, maybe there's a pastry that is like a Twinkie, right? But they've never had a Twinkie. They don't know what the Twinkie is. And if you can't describe the Twinkie, then you don't know what a Twinkie is either, right?
That's very true.
The Twinkie has, it's a very buttery cake-like dough, right? So you would need to talk about that and get to familiarize yourself with what is in it, what makes it that way, in order to help your readers really understand what it is you're seeing. So it is hard to do.
You're making me a better writer.
All I can hope is for us, all of us, to be better eaters, better writers, better people. I think that's what art is. Art helps us strive to be better because the world is so big and we get to be in it. So why not learn how to be better in it?
You're so right. And that's the perfect segue into getting into, let's talk about what's next for you. How are you making the world better? What upcoming projects are coming up that you'd like to share?
Thank you. So I have a few projects. I just launched the Salvi LA series, which I am the host of, and executive produced it. Similar to the lines of, you know, the Salvi Soul cookbook, it took forever. I don't want to wait forever to see a show about Salvadorans in LA. And so I found a grant that would help me do this show, and we've done it. So it premieres. Premiere March 30th, which is later this, or by the time this airs, will already happen. But the show will be out on Salvi Soul's YouTube, and we're very excited about it. And yeah, we have a few more projects that have yet to be launched, so I'll have to hold okay. on that, but lots to keep you know up to date, that I'll definitely be sharing in my newsletter, which you can subscribe to on salvisoul.com and follow on all the socials.
Oh yeah, don't worry, I got an outro to give them all of the details. So when you're a smashing cookbook success and then you're like an award-winning TV host, you can come back on
absolutely.
And announce your other
podcast. Yes, absolutely. I would love it.
Amazing. My last and final question for you is something that I ask every single guest. If there is one cooking appliance or utensil that you think everyone should splurge on, what would it be and why?
Oh, what would it be and why? Goodness gracious. I have so many. I'll tell you one that I really love, and it's an Oosterhobel.
Okay.
It's a kitchen tool that I believe was invented by a Norwegian person, but it's a cheese slicer. And I use it to also make, it gives you the perfect amount of butter. I use it to slice my butter. Huh. And you know how sometimes it's so hard to get butter to melt on bread because it's like the chunk.
Yeah, mine is room temperature right now.
So you either have to get like those little butter bells, which I'm not sure I want that. And so I get my Oosterhobel and it slices my butter in a very thin slice. You probably have to look at it so you can see what I'm just
looking it up right now.
Cheese slicer. And I use it in so many ways. It's there to flip something, kind of has a little spatula. Definitely there to slice my cheese, which I eat so much of it.
Oh, yes. I see.
So it's one of those things that you may not think, oh, I need this. But once you have it, you're like, oh, I have definitely upgraded my kitchen life. And the other thing I'll say that I would be remiss if I don't mention is two pairs of kitchen shears, one for food and one for all the packaging that comes with food. Because I hate.
Wait, that is so timely right now. I need that so bad.
Kitchen scissors, one for the food, because I have a thing about if it's touching food, I don't want it to touch other things. And so packaging gets its own scissor, and then the food scissors for like cutting your herbs or cutting, you know, whatever you're trying to cut. It's just, it does make how you exist in the kitchen a little more comfortable. And I think we can afford those things. So, yeah.
I think so too. I literally just, I accidentally used my kitchen scissors for a package. And I was like, this is so gross right now. I don't know why I'm living like this. I need to buy another pair because the amount of, I'm not like a germ freak, but that's just like gross. These packages go everywhere. You don't know where these packages have been. Like, I don't want to use them on my food or cheese or whatever too. Yes. Well, those are two that I've never gotten before. And I've had a lot of chefs on here.
Wow.
So I think you win so far.
Look at that. Love it.
Normally I get like a knife, good pan. You really hit it out of the park with that one.
And I would say that those are much more affordable than those knives or pans. Because TBH, you will always find a pan or a knife. Those things are, I don't know, they're nice, but sometimes you can't afford a $200 knife. But it makes your life easier if you do have like a $15 scissor that you're like, oh, I don't have to go looking for that thing. Where did I leave it? Your dedicated kitchen shears. It's just like, it makes being in the kitchen and cooking just more like, hey, I got this.
You got it. So now everyone, you have to get kitchen shears. And then right next to it, you will have Carla's cookbook, which will come out. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Cannot say that enough so much for coming on. You are literally amazing. You are so incredibly well-spoken, and I can tell how much heart and soul you put into this book, and I know it's going to be incredible. I'm really excited to see everything, and, you know, congratulations and for thank you for taking the time out. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
You can keep up with Carla's latest recipes on Instagram at @Carla_TV or order the Salvi Soul cookbook, Salvadoran Recipes and the Women Who Preserve Them, out now. Hey, fellow foodies. Thanks so much for listening. And don't forget to leave me a review. While you're at it, make sure to follow me at livinforfoodpod on Instagram or TikTok, or email me at livinforfoodpod@gmail.com. Let me know what you're cooking up this week, which guests you would like to see on the podcast, or tell me your opinions on the latest viral food trend. And in case you're just joining me, there is an entirety of season 1 ready and waiting for you. Until next time.